a look of appeal. He simply grinned. So reluctantly, she opened her mouth, preparing to urge caution on the headstrong Bakuan commander. Whatever word she would have spoken were drowned by Wasi's sudden bellow. Fall off the wind! Within moments, the ship turned to starboard and was running with the wind. Behind, one ship following the other, the fleet copied the maneuver. Antonina held her breath. They were now driving across the oncoming Malwa galleys at what seemed a blinding speed. Collision was almost upon them, and the Malwa vessels, unlike their own, had cruel rams splitting the waves. Only at the last instant did she realize the truth. The Malwa, oared, might be more maneuverable, but they were no faster, not with the Ethiopians sailing before the wind. The Aksum warships would cross their enemies' bows at point-blank range. The Syrian gunners were excellent. And if Antonina had not been able to bring the Theodora, she had been able to bring its gunnery officer, the best gunnery officer in the world. Eusebius's high-pitched screech rang out. The 2 5-inch guns on the port side roared, heeling the ship. When the smoke cleared, 2 5-inch marble balls fired at 30 yards range had split the galley's bow wide open. Both rounds must have struck within inches of each other right on the ship's prow. Once shattered, the heavy bracing which secured the ram acted like so many pile drivers hammering the thin planks of the hull. The Malwa ship opened up like a hideous flower, spilling men and blood into the sea. The gruesome sight fell behind. The second Malwa galley came up also to port. Not enough time had elapsed for the gunners to have reloaded, so Wasi simply sailed on. A few seconds later, Antonina heard the guns of the next ship, then the third, and then the fourth. She didn't turn her head to watch the results. There was no need. Not when she had Usanas and Wasi's cheerful faces to serve as her mirror. More food for the fish, Wasi pronounced. He turned his eyes back to the front. Beyond the bow, he could see the 5 great cargo ships less than a mile away. Soon now, he pointed. Look, they've already set up their rockets. As if his pointing finger had been a signal, a volley of rockets soared away from one of the Malwa vessels. Of the 6 missiles, 5 skittered half aimlessly before they plunged into the sea. But one of the rockets held a straight course until it, too, plowed harmlessly into a wave 200 yards distant. Antonina wasn't relieved by the distance of the miss. His first volley had been a mistake, undoubtedly ordered by a nervous and rattled captain. The range was still too great for rockets to have any real hope of success, but the steadiness with which that one rocket had held its course could only mean one thing. They fitted them with real Venturi. Some of the rockets, anyway, just as Belisarius predicted. She took a breath. I think Wasi was already shouting orders. A moment later, the Ethiopian crew was swarming over the ship, erecting the new rocket shields. Each Aksumite ship was carrying almost 200 soldiers. Most of those men, under normal conditions, would have been busy at the oars. But with the ships under sail, they were free for other work. The shields were erected within minutes. As she watched, Antonina gave herself a silent reproof. Wasi's determination to fight under sail, she now realized, had not been the decision of a truculent male eager to show his mettle. The commander had foreseen the necessity to erect the shields quickly. She glanced at Usanas. The Akabe Tsensen, once again, was grinning at her. She grinned back, accepting the jeer in good humor. I, too, when it comes to this, am nothing but an amateur. Let the professionals handle it. She turned her eyes to the shields. Her own professional pride surfaced. She might not know anything about ships, but she did know gunpowder warfare. Better than anyone in the world, she thought. John of Rhodes might have a superior grasp of theory, but not the practice. Except my husband. After all these months fighting Rajputs in Persia, I'm sure he's better than I am. The thought combined pride and worry. Antonina had no idea if Belisarius was still alive. By now he should have gotten the message she had sent him, telling Belisarius when she would leave Adulis for their rendezvous at Kerax. That message would have been taken by fast horses to the nearest semaphore station at Isla. From there, flashing up and down the line of semaphore stations which she and Belisarius had constructed the year before, the message would have reached Ctesiphon within a day. Persian couriers would carry it to Belisarius' army in the nearby Zagros, again using the fastest horses available. But there had been no way for a message to be returned. Belisarius had told Antonina once of the almost magical communication devices of future centuries. Radio, one was called. Such devices were far beyond the technological capability of her time, and would be, even with aid to guide them, for decades to come. She sighed unhappily. To shake off her anxiety concerning Belisarius, she resumed her study of the shields. Antonina had designed the shields herself before she left Constantinople the year before. Not, of course, without advice from Belisarius, and plenty of help when the time came to translate theory into practice from the Syrians of her Theodoran cohort. The gunners and their wives, being borderers born and bred, were excellent blacksmiths, carpenters, and tanners, and whatever they couldn't handle had been done by the Ethiopian artisans and craftsmen whom King Aeon had put at her disposal in Attolis. Each Aksumite ship had been fitted with iron hoops on the rails near the bow. A heavy wooden ridgepole was affixed to the mainmast. The ridgepole ran parallel to the ship's hull right down the center, its end stabilized in the stem. As soon as Wasi gave the order, the Syrian gunners and the Ethiopian sailors began erecting the shield. While Ethiopians furled the sails, the gunners set sturdy wooden braces in the iron hoops along the rails. Each hoop had a bar welded across the bottom to hold the brace butts. The top end of each brace had a hole drilled through it. As the gunners lowered the braces toward the ridgepole, the Ethiopian sailors began threading rope through the holes. Within minutes, the tops of the braces were bound tightly to the mast and ridgepole structure. The end result was a sloping A-frame which covered the bow of the ship. Other sailors were already tossing ropes over the ridgepole and braces. Quickly, with the speed of experienced seamen, the ropes were drawn tight. The A-frame was now lashed down. The ropes provided further strength along with a filled-in framework. The wives of the gunners, meanwhile, had finished hauling the special armor out of the hold. The spans of boiled leather, already pre-cut and punched with holes, were stitched into the pole and rope framework with thinner cord. The sailors began dousing the leather armor with buckets of seawater. Antonina moved to the bow along with Usanas and Wasi, admiring the handiwork. Wasi didn't share her enthusiasm. "Ugly," he groused. Through a viewing slit in the shield, the commander glared down at the bow waves, which were noticeably smaller. "Slow, clumsy." "Ignore him, Antonina," said Usanas serenely. The Akabe Tensen pointed to the nearest Mawa vessel. The huge cargo ship was less than 400 yards away. Kshatriyas could be seen scurrying about their rocket troughs. "Soon enough he will be glad to have that shield." Seconds later, the Malwa vessel was shrouded in rocket smoke. 6 missiles came streaking across the water. 5 missed, most of them widely. But again, the 6th missile sped straight and true. Antonina held her breath. She was about to discover if her inventor's pride was warranted. It was. The rocket struck the sloping side of the shield and glanced off. The shield boomed like a giant kettle drum. The missile soared into the sky, exploding 50 yards overhead. She blew out her breath as a second relief came to reinforce the first. No impact fuses, thank God. Belisarius didn't think they'd have them yet. Not for cargo vessels, anyway. Theoretically, she knew the shield should protect the ship even from rockets armed with impact fuses. Partially, at least. If the Malwa fuses were anything like the Roman ones, they were crude devices. A glancing impact might very well not be enough to trigger them. And even if it did, most of the force would be spilled across the shield instead of punching through. The design would have been well-nigh useless, of course, against heavy cannonballs, but the Malwa had not yet equipped their ships with cannons. Not these ships, anyway. "Good," grunted Wasi. "It works." Grudgingly. "I didn't really think it would." "And why not?" thought Antonina merrily. "It worked at Hampton Roads, didn't it?" But she kept the thought to herself. Both Wasi and Usanas knew of aid. Usanas, in fact, was one of the people in the world who had entered aid's world of future vision. But they were not really comfortable with the knowledge. At the moment, in the midst of battle, they needed surety and solid ground. It wasn't the best time to launch into a discussion of visions. "Besides, I've got a reputation as a genius to maintain. Won't help that any if I admit I got my design from a future ship called the Merrimack. Another volley erupted from the Malwa ship. Then, seconds later, a flight of missiles soared off the deck of another enemy vessel. Wasi ignored the oncoming rockets. He stooped, sticking his head into the entrance of the shield, and bellowed orders. The orders were passed down to the steersman at the rear. The Ethiopian ship began pulling toward the nearest enemy. Progress was slow, of course. The shield wasn't especially heavy, but it caught the wind like a giant drag. The oarsmen strained, grunting with every sweep of the oars, forcing the craft forward. Fortunately, neither the seas nor the wind were heavy. Antonina had been told they wouldn't be, as a rule, this time of year. She was relieved to find the information accurate. Slow progress is still progress. The Malwa convoy, all merchantmen now that their escorts had been destroyed, were simply seeking to escape the Ethiopians. But the Malwa ships paid a price for their huge and ungainly design. They, too, crept along like snails. Usanas verbalized her own assessment.
"We'll overtake them," he pronounced. "Soon, I think."
Chapter 30. Soon proved to be half an hour. Half an hour after that, soon became never. Antonina once again discovered the first law of battle. Nothing ever works the way it should. "Pull out, Wasi," she shouted, trying to make herself heard over the roar of the cannons and the shrieks of the rockets. "We can't sink them." Stubbornly, the Aksumite commander shook his head. The headshake turned into a duck as another flight of rockets soared overhead. But there was no damage. The Syrian gunners, after a few minutes of battle, had switched to canister. The solid shot had proven ineffective, but the canister kept the Malwa Kshatriyas from the rail. They were not able to lower their rocket troughs far enough to bring the missiles to bear on the Ethiopian warships alongside. "There's no point," she shouted. "We could punch holes in that damn thing for a week and it won't make a difference. We can't sink it." Wasi ignored her. He was leaning out of the shield, studying the rest of the battle. The huge Malwa cargo ships were like buffaloes being torn at by a dozen lean wolves. The roar of cannon fire mingled with the shriek of rocketry rippled over the waves. Each Aksumite ship was wreathed in gun smoke. Every Malwa ship had holes punched in its hull, and none of them, plain as day, was in any danger of sinking. The battle was a pure and simple stalemate. While she waited for Wasi to make a decision, Antonina snarled at her own frustration at the Malwa ship looming above her not 20 yards off. It was an incredible sight in its way. The hull of the Malwa ship looked like a sieve. At least a dozen 5-inch marble cannonballs had punched holes through the thin planks. But I was afraid this might happen. Belisarius warned me that wooden ships in the days of sail were almost never sunk by cannon fire. The Spanish Armada was wrecked by a storm, not English guns. The only ship at the Battle of Trafalgar actually destroyed by gunfire was the Ashiel, after fire spread to its magazines. The rest were captured by boarders or lost during the storm which followed. Still, I had hoped. Those ships, after all, were heavily built northern European craft, not these cockle shells. But it doesn't matter. Wood doesn't sink. It's as simple as that. Another volley of unaimed rockets shrieked overhead. The Malwa were simply venting their own frustration. The missiles plunged into the sea hundreds of yards past the two Aksumite vessels drawn alongside. Wasi ducked back under the shield. The leather was ragged now where a few Malwa rockets had struck early in the battle. But that, at least, had worked as Antonina hoped. Even the one rocket which exploded when it hit the shield had spent most of its fury harmlessly. Only 5 rowers had been injured, none seriously. "We'll do it the old-fashioned way," shouted Wasi. He seized his spear and began bellowing new orders. The rowers drove the ship against the Malwa vessel. Grappling hooks were being dug out and scaling equipment readied. Antonina started to protest. This battle with the convoy had turned into an absurd distraction. They could break off now and still make it into Karax long before the convoy could bring the alarm. The last thing she wanted was to see the Ethiopian forces suffer heavy casualties in a boarding operation. But the protest died on her lips. One look at Wasi's face was enough. The Takuan commander was in pure battle fury. He would have that convoy by God no matter what. She glanced at Usanas. Ikabe Tsensen shrugged. The cannons, after firing a last volley of canister to clear the rail, were being hastily drawn aside. With Wasi in the lead, dozens of Aksumite soldiers tossed their grappling hooks and began swarming up the side of the Mawa ship. Their battle cry, "Ta'aka Mariam! Ta'aka Mariam!" rang with pure bloodlust.
"Forget it, Antonina," said Usanas. "If Ezana were here..."
Usanas glanced at the other Mawa ships. Already he could see other Ethiopian soldiers starting their own boarding operations. And faintly he could hear the same merciless words. "Ta'aka Mariam! Ta'aka Mariam!" He turned back to Antonina.
"Ezana was always the more cool-headed of the two, but I'm not sure even he would be able to restrain the Sawin. Not this far into the battle. Aksum has the most ferocious navy in the Erythraean Sea. They didn't get that way by being timid."
Antonina sighed and leaned against one of the poles bracing the shield. Her face was covered with sweat and the streaks left by gunsmoke. The interior of the shielded bar, under the heat of mid-autumn afternoon, was a sweltering pit.
"Let's just hope, then," she muttered.
"Relax."
Usanas studied her with his intelligent eyes.
"You're thinking about that other boarding operation, aren't you? Where we, Belisarius and his companions, slaughtered the Arab pirates who tried to storm our ship."
She nodded wearily. Usanas gave her a reassuring little pat on the shoulder.
"Relax, I say."
He paused for a moment, listening to the sounds of combat coming from the deck above. Then, very calmly,
"Four things are different here. First, the Arabs were facing a large force of Yetai escorting Lord Venantakatra. These cargo ships have only a handful of the murderous bastards. Second, the Arabs didn't have canister to clear their way to the deck. Half of them died before they made it over the rail. Third, they were pirates, not Aksumite marines. Finally..."
His great grin erupted. In the gloom of the shield's interior, it seemed to Antonina like a beacon.
"And finally, fool woman, these sorry Mawa bastards don't have your husband to save their hides."
"Or me," he added modestly, caressing the shaft of his spear.
"Especially me, now that I think about it."
He seized the great spear and began prancing about, feigning lunges and thrusts.
"I was terrible. A fury, a demon from below."
Antonina managed her own grin. Despite herself, Usanas's antics were cheering her up. It was impossible to wallow in misery for very long around Usanas. There was a sudden surge in the battle clangor. Hurriedly, Antonina stuck her head out of the shield and peered up at the rail. A moment later, a small flood of Malwa sailors and Kshatriyas began diving overboard. Their own shouts of fear were pursued by the sounds of murder.
"Ta'aka Mariam! Ta'aka Mariam!"
One of the leaping Malwa, misjudging in his terror, landed on the rail of her ship. His body seemed to snap in half, not 10 feet from her. The sound of the impact combined breakage and rupture, like sticks in a bag of offal slammed against stone. Antonina thought his back was broken. It was a moot point. Even before her bodyguards, Matthew and Leo, unlimbered their weapons, Usanas pushed past her and stabbed the fallen sailor with his spear. The great leaf blade opened his chest and drove him over the side. She craned her head up. Another, a Yetai warrior, had his back pressed to the rail, fighting an unseen opponent. Not 2 seconds after she spotted him, she saw a spear drive through his chest. The bloodied blade was sticking 4 inches out of his back. The Yetai was driven half over the rail by the power of the blow. He toppled over, falling into the sea, the spear still sticking into his body. Wasi appeared at the rail, grabbing for the haft of the spear. Too late. The Takuan commander's face was contorted with rage. He shook his fist at the plunging body of the Yetai.
"That was my best spear," he roared. "You stinking—"
Then everything seemed to happen at once, and yet to Antonina as slowly as anything she had ever seen. Wasi's face was suddenly a mask of not shock so much as simple surprise. Then he was flying through the air, soaring over the waves as if he were a bird. The Mawa rocket which had struck him right in the spine was carrying him out to sea like a gull. For a moment his arms even seemed to be flapping. But Antonina, seeing the burning fury pouring out of his back, knew that the man was already dead. The burning gunpowder reached the warhead. The rocket exploded 30 yards from the ship and half as many above the waves. The largest piece of Wasi which struck the water was his right leg. The rest of the Dakuan commander was simply a cloud of blood and shreds of flesh and bone.
God in heaven, she whispered.
She turned a shocked face to Usanas. The Akabe Tsensen clenched his teeth. Then, without a word, he took his spear and raced toward the grappling ropes amidships. Within seconds, Antonina saw him swarming onto the ship. At first, she assumed that Usanas was just venting his own fury and battle lust. But then, hearing his bellowing roars, she realized that he was doing the opposite. The Akabe Tsensen was taking command and dragging the Sarwan away from their pointless revenge. Literally dragging, in some cases. She saw Usanas personally pitch 3 Ethiopian marines onto the rail. He had to wrap one of them on the skull with the haft of his spear before the man started climbing down the ropes. Blood was beginning to drip over the sides of the Mawa ship above her. Antonina didn't want to think about the carnage up there. At the best of times, Aksumite Sarwen were murderous in battle. Now, with their regimental commander slain, they were fury incarnate.
What a waste, she whispered. What a pointless, stupid waste.
She stared out at the patch of ocean where Wasi had disappeared, what was left of him. There would be no point, she knew, in searching for the pieces of his body. The fish would get them long before they could be retrieved. She wiped her face, smearing sweat and smoke and more than a few tears.
What a waste, she whispered again. What a stupid, stupid, stupid waste.
It took Usanas 15 minutes to get the Ethiopian soldiers off the Malwa vessel. By then, any Malwa was long dead, except for the few who might have found a hiding place in the hold below. Usanas had to bully a dozen Sarwen from wasting time searching the cargo. At his order, the Ethiopian ships cast off and began rowing toward the other ships being boarded. Soon enough, the Akabe Tsensen was repeating his actions, bringing the battle to a halt. That didn't prove difficult. All 5 Malwa vessels had been stormed. As Usanas had predicted, Malwa cargo ships were simply no match for Aksumite marines. Wisely, Usanas said nothing of Wasi's death until the Ethiopian fleet had resumed its course up the Persian Gulf. The 5 Malwa vessels were left behind, wallowing in the waves. Already, the Arab dhows were closing in. When the news was passed from one ship to another, Usanas had to re-establish his authority anew. He was forced to personally visit one of the ships crewed by men of the Dakuan Sawe to beat down what almost amounted to a mutiny.
Stupid fools, he snarled to Antonina after clambering back aboard the flagship. They were bound and determined to go back and see that not a single Mawa was left alive.
She looked at the cluster of Malwa ships, now several miles astern. The Arab dhows were tied alongside like lampreys. She shook her head.
That's stupid, roared Usanas.
The Akabe Tsensen gestured angrily at the ships being plundered.
What do they think the Arabs won't do that they would?
He glared astern.
Any Malwa cowering in a hold is having his throat slit, even as we speak.
Antonina grimaced. Maybe not. They might capture them in order...
Better yet, bellowed Usanas. Better yet! We can lullaby ourselves to sleep, thinking of Malwa's slaves hauling water for Bedouin women.
He shook his head.
But they won't be so lucky, believe me.
The ships were India-bound, Antonina, loaded with booty from Persia. The Sarwen grabbed some, but most of it was left behind. Those Arabs are now the richest men in the Hadramaut. What do they want with some mangy Malwa slaves? They can buy better ones back home. He made a savage, slitting gesture across his throat.
Fish food, that's all.
Usanas leaned on the rail, gripping the wood in his powerful hands. The anger faded from his eyes, replaced by sorrow.
What a waste, he murmured. What a stupid waste. All for a stinking convoy that was never anything more than an accidental diversion. He shook his head sadly. We cannot even do the rites. Nothing left. Antonina placed her hand on Osanus's shoulder and shook it firmly.
That is also stupid. Of course we can do the rites. We're not pagans, Osanus.
What had become her husband's most treasured saying came to her mind.
Only the soul matters in the end. We can pray for Wasi's soul, and those of the other men who died.
Osanus sighed, lowering his head. Then he snorted.
What other men?
For a moment, his grin almost appeared.
Wasi was the only casualty. The only fatality, at least.
Antonina's jaw sagged. Seeing the expression, Osanus did manage a wan and feeble grin.
I told you, woman.
He tossed his head, sneering at the Malwa ships fading into the distance.
Sheep in the hands of Ethiopian marines? Nothing but sheep. The only wounds were caused by Yetai, and even they could do no better. There are no soldiers in the world as good as Aksumite Sawen, Antonina, in the close quarters of a boarding operation.
He rubbed his face. The gesture was sad, not weary.
Even the rocket which killed Wasi was fired by accident. A gaggle of Kshatriyas were trying to turn it around to face their attackers. The fuse was lit, one of them killed by a spear. He stumbled, fell, knocked the rocket off askew.
Osanus waved his hand.
Stupid, he muttered. Just one of those stupid, pointless deaths which happen in a battle. That's all it was.
Marcy's death was far more than that when the funeral ceremony was held the next day. By then, after hundreds of Ethiopian soldiers had whispered through the night, the Sarawit had come to their own conclusions. There was a part of Antonina, as she listened to the lays and chants, there were bards among the soldiers, amateurs but good at their business, which thought the whole thing absurd. But that was only a part of the woman's soul, and a small one at that. The soul which stood at her center did not begrudge the soldiers their myth. By the time the expedition returned to Ethiopia, she knew Wasi would have entered Africa's own warrior legends. His death, leading a great sea battle, would become a thing of glory. She didn't begrudge the Sarwen those legends. She wouldn't have begrudged them even if she weren't the leader of an expedition to rescue her husband from destruction. But since she was, she certainly didn't intend to start spouting nitpicking, picayune, petty little truths. Leave that for antiquarians and historians of the future. Osanus spoke her thoughts aloud.
Pity the poor Malwa at Karax,
he said cheerfully, as he and Antonina listened to the chants.
That stupid death has turned a shrewd maneuver against enemy logistics into a crusade. They would storm the gates of hell now.
Chapter 31. Karax. Autumn, 532 AD. When the captain of the unit guarding Karax's northeastern gate was finally able to discern the exact identity of the oncoming troops, he wasn't a happy man.
Shit, he cursed softly. Kushans.
The face of his lieutenant, standing 3 feet away, mirrored the captain's own alarm.
Are you sure?
The captain pulled his eye away from the telescope mounted on the ramparts and gave his lieutenant an irritated look. See for yourself if you don't believe me, he snarled, stepping away from the telescope. The lieutenant made no move to take his place. The question hadn't been asked seriously. It was impossible to mistake Kushans for anyone else once they got close enough for the telescope to pick out details. If for no other reason, no one in Persia beyond Kushans bound up their hair in topknots. The captain marched over to the inner wall of the battlement and leaned over. A dozen of his soldiers were standing on the ground below, their heads craned up, waiting to hear the news.
Kushans, he shouted.
The soldiers grimaced.
Summon the commander of the watch, bellowed the captain.
Then, more loudly still,
and hide the women.
The latter command was unneeded. The soldiers were already scurrying about, rounding up the slave women whom the guard battalion had dragooned into their service. Not that those women needed any chivying. Except for the cosmopolitan sprinkling typical of a great port, the women were Persian and Arab. Some had been captured during the sack of Kerax when the Malwa first took the port. Others had been seized by one or another of the raiding columns which the Malwa had sent ravaging Mesopotamia over the past year and a half. They detested their captors, true, but they had even less desire to be seized by soldiers arriving at Kerax after weeks on campaign. The garrison troops were foul and brutal, but at least they were no longer rampant. Let the poor creatures in the military brothels handle these new arrivals. The women in the guard compound were even more determined than their masters to stay out of sight. Satisfied that the necessary immediate measures were being taken, the guard captain slouched back to his post. In his absence, the lieutenant had manned the telescope. "Good news," announced the lieutenant, his eye still at the telescope. "Most of that lot are prisoners. Must be 10,000 of them." The captain grunted with satisfaction. That was good news. Excellent news, actually, and on two counts. First, it meant that the Malwa had scored a big victory somewhere. The captain was relieved. Ever since the disaster at the Nahar Malka, followed by a year of frustration, the commanders of the Malwa army had been like so many half-lamed tigers, nursing wounded paws and broken teeth, and venting their anger on subordinates. A victory, thought the captain, would help to ease the sullen atmosphere. Secondly, and more important for the immediate future, it meant that the Kushans would be kept busy. The slave laborers which the Malwa Empire's early victories in Mesopotamia netted had long since been worked to death, except for the women kept for the army's pleasure. Until the new prisoners were securely fitted into slave labor battalions and set to work expanding the harbor, the Kushans would be needed to guard them. That meant they wouldn't have idle time on their hands to go looking for the better women and wine which the garret troopers would have stashed away. They would have to be satisfied with the hags in the brothels and the vinegar which passed for wine in the barracks. He could see that an advance party of Kushans was cantering toward the gate. The main body of Kushans and their captives was not more than 200 yards away. The captain turned, looking for the commander of the watch. The Sot should have arrived by now to order the opening of the gates. In turning, the captain caught a glimpse of the soldiers standing by a siege gun positioned on the great firing platform appended to the wall. As always, the gun was pointed toward the desert. By now, the gun crew would have loaded the weapon with canister. One of the soldiers was removing the firing rod from the furnace. The bent tip of the rod was glowing red, ready to be inserted into the touch hole. Angrily, the captain shouted at him. His words were not orders. They were not even particularly coherent, just a string of profanities. Hastily, the soldier quenched the rod in a nearby bucket. "Fucking idiots," snarled the captain. Next to him, the lieutenant shook his head. "Just what we need," he groused. "Some stupid jackass to fire a load of canister into a couple of thousand Kushans." The lieutenant made for the ladder and began scurrying down. "I'll get over there," he said. "Make sure there aren't any other imbeciles roaming around loose." His head disappeared below the wall. "Kushans," came his voice. Again, the captain looked for the watch commander. Seeing the soldier he had sent on the search standing below, alone, he cursed under his breath. The soldier looked up, spread his hands, shrugged. "Not even sundown and the bastard's already drunk." The captain sighed. He hated taking responsibility for anything, much less opening the city's gate. But he eyed the oncoming troops. Kushans. Hot, tired, thirsty, horny, and they just want a victory. "I don't get that gate open, they'll come over the walls and..." The thought was too gruesome to contemplate further. The captain bellowed new commands. By the time the advance party of Kushans arrived, the gates were open. Wide enough, at least, to admit a dozen horsemen. It would take another full minute to swing the huge, heavy gates completely aside. To the captain's surprise, the leader of the Kushans clambered up the ladder as soon as he dismounted. The captain had expected him to join his fellows at the well below. The guards were already circulating among the new arrivals, flavoring the well water with wine poured from amphorae, doing what they could to assuage the new arrivals, who would know full well that the garret troopers had good wine hidden somewhere about. Hopefully the Kushans would be satisfied with the hospitality and not go searching in the cellars. So let's be hospitable, muttered the captain to himself. He went to greet the Kushan climbing onto the rampart, hands outstretched. A great victory, he cried, beaming from ear to ear. The Kushan returned the grin with one of his own.
Better than you think, he replied.
Proudly, the Kushan pointed to the oncoming mass of prisoners.
Those are Romans, Belisarius's men. We smashed them not 6 days ago, routed them, even got their horses.
The captain had wondered a bit, seeing so many of the prisoners still mounted. The majority were marching on foot, manacled in long chains, but there were at least 4,000 captives who were simply manacled to their saddles.
Then again, if I were one of those Romans, I wouldn't try to escape either. Horse be damned. Just like those crazy Kushans to make a game out of hunting you down. Gut you along with your horse and then drag you with your own intestines. Drag the horse too, probably.
The Kushan leader seized the captain in a hearty embrace. Gasping for breath but not daring to complain, the captain studied the nearest prisoners. The first ranks were now within 30 yards of the gate. At the very forefront were two tall men. One of them was so huge he was almost a giant. The captain grimaced.
Glad I didn't have to catch that monster. Let's hear it for garrison duty.
To the captain's relief, the Kushan drew away from the bear hug and gestured toward the nearby gun platform.
You did quench the firing rods, he demanded.
The Kushan's smile thinned, became less friendly.
We don't want any accidents now, do we?
The smile became very thin.
We wouldn't even bother looking for your women. Time we were done, you could fit one of those siege guns up your ass.
The captain shook his head hastily. Reassurances began pouring out of his mouth. To his relief, the friendly grin returned.
Enough said, exclaimed the Kushan.
He seized the captain's arms and squeezed them reassuringly. The first prisoners had reached the gate. They were being marched in 10 abreast, with Kushan guards flanking them on both sides. The huge one at the fore, noticed the captain, really was a giant. He positively dwarfed the man next to him, even though that man was big himself. The captain made a quick decision.
Listen, he said softly, conspiratorially. You come...
He glanced at the horizon. The sun was almost setting.
Tonight, after dark. Bring a few of your officers, if you want.
He gave the Kushan a friendly leer.
I'll have some fresh young women for you.
He started to make a jocular shrug, but the Kushan's hands were still on his arms.
Well, they're not all that fresh, of course.
The prisoners were pouring through now, spilling onto the flat expanse inside the walls. The column barely fit the gate, even as wide as it was. The Kushans were chivying the captives mercilessly, driving them in like a human flood.
But they're better than the broken-down cunts in the brothels.
Cackling. Last week, half the crew of a cargo ship got through one of the bitches before they noticed she was dead. He cackled again. The Kushan joined in the humor, laughing uproariously. Apparently, he found the thing so funny that he couldn't stop squeezing the captain's arms. The Kushan was very strong. The captain began to wince. The wince turned into a gasp. A horse had kicked him in the stomach. The captain couldn't understand where the horse had come from. He was on his knees. He didn't understand how he'd gotten there. And he saw, but didn't understand, how a sword was in the Kushan's hand. The sword moved. The captain's vision was blurred for an instant, as if he were being tumbled about in a barrel. He heard vague and muffled sounds like shouts and screams filtered through wool. And the captain's eyes refocused. His cheek was pressed to the stone floor of the rampart. A few feet away, blood was pumping out of the neck of a headless corpse. The noise was soft, rhythmic. Splash, splash. He just had time, before everything went dark, to realize that he was staring at his own body. Chapter 32.
I thought at first that you'd move too quickly, said Belisarius.
He finished cleaning the blood from his sword and tossed the rag into a corner of the room. The tattered piece of cloth torn from a Malwa soldier's tunic landed suddenly on a large pile of its fellows. From the grisly mound of linen, a pool of blood was spreading slowly across the stone floor, reflecting the light from the lamps on the walls. It was a large floor. The room had once been the audience chamber of Kerax's viceroy before the Malwa turned it into their military headquarters. But even that floor was now half-stained. The blood pooling from the heap of bodies in one corner had almost joined that spilling from the rags. Vasudeva shrugged.
I had planned to wait until everyone was through the gates, but there was always the danger of someone spotting something wrong.
And besides, he shrugged again. Kutsis, sitting at a nearby table with his feet propped up, laughed gaily.
Admit it, maniac of the steppes.
The young Syrian general lifted his cup, saluting the Kushan.
You just couldn't resist, like a wolf with a lamb in its jaws trying to withstand temptation.
Kutsis downed the cup in a single gulp, then grimaced.
God, I hate plain water, even from a well.
But Kutsis didn't even glance at the amphorae lining the shelf on a nearby wall. Belisarius had given the most draconian orders the day before on the subject of liquor. The general had seen what happened to an army storming a city if it started to drink. Troops could be hard enough to control at such times even when they were stone sober. It was essential, imperative, that Kerax stay intact until the Roman army was ready to leave. Drunken troops, among their multitude of other crimes, are invariably arsonists. Let fire run loose in Kerax with its vast arsenal of gunpowder, and ruin was the sure result. Belisarius slid the sword back into its scabbard.
I wasn't criticizing, he said mildly.
Once I realized what caliber of opponent we were facing, I was only surprised that you'd waited so long. Buzis came through the door. His sword was still in his hand, but the blade was clean. A few streaks indicated that it had been put to use, but not apparently in the past few minutes. Kutsi's brother was scowling fiercely.
Where did they find this garbage? He demanded. Did they round up every pimp in India and station them here?
He seemed genuinely aggrieved. Morris, leaning against a nearby wall, chuckled.
What did you expect, lad?
He tossed his head northward.
Every soldier worth his name is marching along the Euphrates, ready to fight Khosrow. The Malwa must have figured they could garrison a place this well fortified with anybody who could walk.
Some of them couldn't even do that, snapped Buzis. Half the garrison was already drunk before we even started the assault. The sun hadn't gone down yet.
His scowl became a thing purely feral.
They won't walk now, for sure. Not ever.
I would like as many prisoners as possible, Buzis, said Belisarius. As before, his tone was mild.
Yes, agreed Aid.
The more enemy soldiers we can shove out the gates, the more mouths Link will have to feed, with nothing to feed them with.
Buzis flushed under the implied reproof.
I tried, General.
He gave a quick, appealing glance at the other commanders in the room. We all tried, but... Norris levered himself off the wall with a push of the shoulder and took two steps forward. Buzis gave a small sigh of relief.
Forget it, General, said Morris harshly. If there's 500 of that scum left tomorrow morning to push out into the desert, I'll be surprised. There'll be no mercy for Malwa this night. Not after the men found the torture chambers and the brothels. Any Mahaveda priest or Mahami Mamsa who died by the blade can count himself lucky. The men are dragging most of them to the torture chambers to give them a taste of their own pleasures.
Along with any soldier they caught within sight of one of the brothels, growled Kutsis.
Jesus.
Belisarius didn't argue the matter. He had seen one of the brothels himself. Roman soldiers were not, to put it mildly, the gentlest men in the world. Nor was gallantry a word which anyone in their right mind would ever associate with them. Any Roman veteran, and they were all veterans now, had spent his own time in a military brothel, filing through a crib for a few minutes' pleasure. But the scene in that brothel had been something out of a nightmare. A nightmare which would have roused Satan from his sleep, trembling and shaken. Long rows of women, girls probably, though it was impossible to determine their age, chained, spread-eagled on thin pallets. On occasion, judging from residual moisture, they had been splashed with a pail of water to clean them off. All the women were sick. Most suffered from bed sores. Many were dying. Not a few were already dead. No, Roman soldiers were not what a later age would call knights in shining armor. But they had their own firm concept of manhood nonetheless, which was not that of pimps and sadists. The women in the brothels were all Persian or Arab, just like the women those soldiers had been consorting with since they began their campaign in Persia. Many Roman soldiers had married their kinsfolk. Among Persians, since the Malwa invasion began, the name of Karax had been synonymous with bestiality. Their Roman allies, friends and husbands as often as not, had absorbed that notion over the past year and a half. Now, having seen the truth with their own eyes, they would exact Persia's vengeance. And besides, mused Aid whimsically, they spent the last 6 months fighting Rajputs. Can't do that, not even the crudest brawler recruited in Constantinople's Hippodrome, without some of the chivalry rubbing off. Belisarius's eyes fell on the pile of corpses in a corner. The body of the Malwa garrison's commander was on the very top. Belisarius himself had put the body there with a thrust through the heart, after the man had failed to stutter surrender quickly enough. For just an instant, Belisarius regretted that sword thrust. He could have disarmed the man, saved him for the torture pits. He shook off the thought, took a deep breath and forced down his own rage, seething somewhere deep inside. This was no time for rage. If he was having a hard enough time controlling his fury, he could well imagine the mental state of his troops. That fury can't be stopped, but it must be controlled. He turned his eyes back on his commanders. All of them were staring at him, respectfully, but stubbornly. He forced a smile. I'm not arguing the point, Morris, but if it gets out of control, if the men... Don't worry about it, interrupted Morris brusquely, shaking his head. He pointed to the row of amphorae lining the shelf. To the best of my knowledge, that's the only liquor left in Karax which hasn't already been spilled in the streets. More often than not, the men do it themselves before they're even ordered. No one wants any Malwa to escape because some bastard was too drunk to spot them. As for the women... He shrugged. Kutsis lazed to his feet and strode over to the shelf. As he began plucking amphorae and tossing them through a nearby window, he said, The only problem there, General, is that any woman in Karax who's managed to stay out of the brothels, hooking up with a garrison unit usually, or an officer, is throwing herself at a Roman soldier tonight. The first sounds of shattering wine flasks came from the street below. Can't blame them. They'll do anything to get out of here. So would I. Finishing with the last amphora, he turned back, grinning. Even if it meant being called Kutsis the Catamite for the rest of my life. Belisarius chuckled, along with his officers. All right, he said. I don't care about that. I don't expect my soldiers to be saints and monks. By tomorrow, we'll have regular camp followers. As long as the women are treated decently enough and the men are kept from liquor, I'll be satisfied. We'll take the women with us when we leave. Those who want will try to reunite with their families. Most of them don't have any families left, grated Boozies. Except us, added Morris. The Kiliarch's gray eyes were as grim as death. He hooked a thumb toward the window. Now that the sounds of breaking amphorae had ended, the screams could be heard again. I'm telling you, General, relax. That isn't the sound of a city being sacked by troops raging out of control, raping, drinking, and burning. That's just the sound of an executioner doing his duty. After a moment, Belisarius nodded. He decided Morris was right. The focused fury of an army he could control. He slapped his hands together. The sharp sound echoed in the room, snapping his officers alert. Let's get to the rest, then. He turned to Vasudeva. Where does it stand with the ships? Vasudeva stroked his topknot. The pleasure he so obviously took in the act almost made Belisarius laugh. The last word I got from Cyril, maybe half an hour ago, was that all of the cargo ships had been seized, except one which managed to pull free from the docks before the Greeks could get to it. Most of the galleys, of course, escaped also. The Kushan shrugged. No way to stop them before they reached the screen of galleys in the outer harbor, not without firing rockets or flame arrows. So Cyril let it be. He says we've got more ships than we need anyway, and he didn't want to risk an explosion or a drifting fireship.
God, no, exclaimed Boozies.
The young officer shuddered slightly. Carax was a city made of stone and brick. It wouldn't burn easily, if at all. But it was also, for all practical purposes, a gigantic powder keg. The port had been the arsenal for Malwa's intended conquest of Persia. The Greeks hadn't searched the ships yet, continued Vasudeva, although I imagine by now they've probably... He broke off, hearing footsteps, then waving his hand. But let's let him tell us. Cyril was marching through the door. As soon as he entered, his eyes fell on the pile of corpses in the corner. Gone off too easy, the swine, he muttered. Turning to Belisarius, he said, We've started the search. Everything looks good. Lucky for us, none of the priests were stationed aboard any of the craft. That had always been Belisarius's deepest fear. Some of the huge ships moored at the dock had been loaded with gunpowder. A fanatic priest aboard one of them, if certain of capture, would have ignited its cargo. The explosion might well have destroyed the harbor along with the Roman escape route. Nobody else? He asked. Cyril smiled. The only ones aboard were sailors. After we stormed a few of the ships, the rest negotiated surrender. Once we were sure all of them were on the docks and the ships were secured, his smile was as grim as Morris's eyes. We gave them new terms of surrender. They weren't happy about it, but he shrugged. Their protests were short-lived. Another laugh swept the room. Even Belisarius joined in. There would be no mercy for Malwa from anyone that night. A dog barking in Hindi would have been slaughtered. Belisarius turned to Boozies. Without being prompted, the young Thracian officer moved back to the window and began pointing to the walls beyond. The gesture was a bit futile. It was still long before sunrise. The darkness was unbroken except by slowly moving Roman squads holding torches aloft in their search for Malwa hideaways. All of the siege guns have been seized and manned. I talked to Felix just 20 minutes ago. He gave Cyril a half-apologetic glance over his shoulder. Unlike the Greeks, who have plenty of seamen, Gregory doesn't have anyone who's fired guns that size, so he kept maybe 24 Malwa gunners alive. Felix says they're babbling everything they know, faster than we can ask. Good, grunted his brother. By tomorrow morning we can fire a few test rounds, using them for the shot. Again, savage humor filled the room, and again Belisarius joined them. Even aid. Why not? The British did during the Indian Mutiny. Unlike them, we've even got a decent excuse. The bloodthirsty aura of that thought didn't surprise Belisarius. He only wondered for a moment at the vastness of the universe, which could produce over the eons such miracles as a crystal intelligence learning human wrath. His eyes came back to Vasudeva. From experience with the Kushan since he entered the service of Rome, Belisarius had learned to use him as his executive officer in matters of logistics. Vasudeva was as proficient a lieutenant in that complex work as Morris was on the battlefield. Vasudeva tugged his goatee. Everything's still a mess, of course. Will be till at least tomorrow night. But I'm not worried about it. He spread his arms, hands wide open, as if he were embracing a beloved but obese friend. There were 15,000 men garrisoned here permanently. Between their stores and the huge stockpiles for the main army, the Malwa have bequeathed a treasure upon us. We don't really have to organize much of anything. Just grab what we need, load up the ships, and get ready to leave when the time comes. Won't take more than 3 days. The Malwa army should be back here by then, opined Cyril. Their first elements, anyway. Enough to invest the city. Morris made a fist and inspected his knuckles. That'll be too late. Way too late. By the day after tomorrow, we'll be able to hold Carax against them. For 3 weeks, at the very least.
A month and a half wouldn't surprise me, although I don't want to think about our casualties by then. And now all eyes were on Belisarius. He smiled, widely, not crookedly. All rage and fury vanished as he remembered that other, much deeper side of life.
"She'll come," he said. "She'll come."
Chapter 33. The Tigris. Autumn, 532 AD.
In the event, Lord Demodera lost Sangha's services for only 9 days. On the morning of the 10th, the Rajput king strode into Demodera's pavilion and slammed the truth onto his commander's table. Demodera stared at the object resting before him. At his side, he sensed Narsi's start of surprise. A moment later, the eunuch hissed. The truth was a helmet. A great, heavy, ungainly contraption of segmented steel plates. A Goth helmet, Demodera vaguely realized. "We found a small mountain of the things," said Sangha, "along with all the other gear those mercenaries were wearing." Demodera looked up. "Where?" Sangha glowered at the helmet. "Do you remember that small valley we passed through where the Persians had been mining?" He snorted. "I remember noticing how fresh the mine tailings were. I was impressed at the time by the courage and determination of the Persian miners to have kept working till the last minute with a war raging about their heads."
"Maternal!" exclaimed Narses. "There was a tunnel there, a mine at it."
Sangha shook his head. "That is no mine, Narses. They disguised the first few dozen yards to make it look like one, but it's really an entrance to a khanat." He pointed at the helmet. "We found those about 50 yards in, piled in a heap, as I said. It took us an hour to move the stuff aside and go beyond. Thereafter..." He pulled up a chair and sat down heavily. "From that point on, the trail is as clear as the one we have been following. Belisarius's entire army, I am as certain of it as I am of my own name, took that route. Hidden from sight underground, they marched to the south. They probably emerged miles away in another valley. The Persian allies would have had fresh horses waiting for them." He slapped the map with his hand. "That is why Belisarius was always willing to let us move north, but was so stubborn an opponent to the south. He was protecting the location of the tunnel. It must have taken them weeks, months to prepare everything, even with help from the Persians. He couldn't afford to have us stumble upon his secret by accident in the course of our maneuvers." Demodera's eyes were wide open. His next words were almost choked out.
"Are you telling me that..."
He waved his hand weakly as if to encompass all of time and space.
"Everything we've done for months, all the maneuvers and the fighting, even the battle at the pass, was a feint?"
Sangha nodded. "Yes, Lord, it was all a feint. Belisarius was buying time, yes, but he wasn't buying time for Emperor Khosrow or his Manigathius in Peroshapur. He was buying it for himself. Until the time was right and the preparations were finished and he could finally strike at his true target. Now that Emperor Khosrow's retreat has drawn our main army out of Carax, the Roman can drive home the death stroke."
"Here," said Sangha.
His finger speared a point on the map. "At Carax." Demodera's eyes, already wide, were almost bulging.
"That's insane," he cried.
"Carax is the most fortified place in the world. Even without the main army there, the garrison is still the size of Belisarius's army. Bigger. There's no way on earth he could storm the place, not even if he had siege guns." Narses interrupted. His voice was dry and cold, like arctic ice. "Have you ever heard of the Trojan horse, Lord Demodera?" he asked. The Malwa lord twisted his head, transferring the incredulous gaze to Narses. The old eunuch chuckled humorlessly. "Never mind. I will tell you the tale some other time. But you can trust me on this, Lord. That..." He jabbed a finger at the helmet resting on the table. "That is a Trojan helmet." Narses laughed.
There was actual humor in that laugh, mixed with rueful admiration.
God, has the world ever seen such a schemer?
He laughed again.
Those helmets, Lord de Murderer, tell you the truth. They were discarded by Belisarius's 2,000 Goth mercenaries, now that they no longer needed them to maintain the disguise. For those men who were never Goths to begin with.
De Murderer's mind finally tracked the trail. His eyes remained wide. His jaws tightened. The next words came between clenched teeth. There were 2,000 Kushans in the army which Belisarius destroyed at Anatha last year. We always assumed they were slaughtered along with the rest.
Ranasanga ran fingers through his thick hair. Then he too laughed, and like Narses, his laugh was mixed rue and admiration.
He used the same trick against us in India, mused Sanga. Turned the allegiance of Kushans and then left a false trail so that the Kushans could do his real work.
De Murderer was back to staring at the map. After a moment, his eyes narrowed.
This still doesn't make sense, he said softly.
He tapped his finger on the location of Karax.
I can see where he might get into Karax using Kushans as his entry, and certainly once he got in,
De Murderer snorted.
His soldiers against garrison troops would be like wolves in a sheep pen.
Slowly, the Malwa lord rose up, leaning on the table. His eyes went back and forth from Sangha to Narses.
But then, how does he get out?
Again, De Murderer's finger tapped the map. This time, very forcefully, like a finger of accusation.
Our main force is still not more than a few days' march away from Karax. Before Belisarius could finish his work of destruction, he would be surrounded by the largest army in the world. No way to escape. He couldn't even sail out on the cargo ships in the harbor. He couldn't get through the screen of war galleys stationed in the outer harbor, and not even Belisarius, not even behind those fortifications, can hold more than a few weeks against 15-1 odds. 2 months at the outside.
Again, the jabbing finger.
It's a suicide mission, he exclaimed. Impossible.
Sanga shook his head.
Why so, Lord? Belisarius is as courageous as any man alive. I would lay down my life for my country and honor. Why would not he?
De Murderer was shaking his head before the Rajput even finished.
That's not the point, Sanga. For honor and country, yes, but for this?
Sanga stared up at De Murderer as if he were gazing at a unicorn or a cretin.
Lord De Murderer, he said, speaking slowly, do you understand what Belisarius will do once he is in Karax?
De Murderer.